You can look at it that way. You can also know that there is suffering. You understand that you're suffering now. Or you can look at it that suffering, the cause of suffering has been understood, the whole thing's been understood as one piece. So you look at it both ways. But you need the whole formulation to come to the conclusion, don't you? Yeah. So and when you say it has been understood, you're kind of willing to stand under it, as it were. But also you could say it has been understood, you've understood the cause and the end of suffering, so you've understood Nirodha. So you could look at it both ways. And the other three, or that, does that cover it, or?
In terms of experience, if I accept suffering, if I'm just willing to be with it, it will evaporate. So for me, I understand that it is a similar element also in the second and in the third noble truth. So just in terms of applying it, it appears already, the whole thing.
Yeah, it's momentary, not necessarily linear again, but you will find sometimes you know you're suffering, but there'll be some misunderstanding in the suffering too, correct? Like if something extreme, you might not have the patience to endure it. Like extreme emotional, something extremely emotionally negative, say, loss, like in a relationship, right? It'll be so strong that you'll understand you're suffering, but you'll still have resistance to it, and the full acceptance of it won't be there. So then you need to turn to those others. So what's the real problem here? Is it that I just feel like terribly lonely, or is it I don't want the loneliness? Right. So, but sometimes the whole thing just reveals itself. You know, like you're just feeling a bit annoyed at someone in the kitchen for not washing up, say. You know, they left their dishes again, and then you just notice it and say, oh, just this way, you're fully with it, it evaporates. Right? So the reason you have, I think, all four is because you sometimes need to investigate. Just like something very powerful, very negative, like physical pain that your Mu has in the hips and that kind of stuff. You know, it's, you got the theory, I know I'm suffering, but the resistance is there, so you always come back to desire and letting go of desire. And then sometimes it's like it's, the whole thing is there, the whole package is there. Sometimes you need to break it down. Especially those deeply ingrained, like physical pain, you constantly have to work with it because you're biologically conditioned to try to get rid of it, to be comfortable, because pain indicates a lack of function. So there's always a need to awaken to what's the desire, let go of that. Sometimes you see it right away, sometimes you have to remind yourself. But what's very difficult are like strong emotional tendencies and preferences and biases that get stimulated and you just run with them. And even though you know this is suffering, knowing what's the desire around it sometimes just takes a continual reawakening. What's the problem here? What's the problem here? And then you see it and it all falls away. So we're moving towards desirelessness. You could say that's the goal. It's the third noble truth. Desirelessness, not in terms of functional. Your functional desire is normal. I want the dust to be cleaned from the fan. So we cleaned it. So that's just functional desire. That's normal. But that kind of existential desire that we have, that's what we're trying to understand and let go of. So desirelessness, the end of desire. And then that's the formulation of Four Noble Truths points to that. Yeah, so I think if you get all four, and you know that, and also I think like you keep seeing insights like this. It's a simple teaching, but you keep getting these kind of insights from your own observation and contemplation. It's deeper and deeper. Please, another one. Please, sir, any more?
Yeah, random. If you look back in memory, and there's sort of a thread, like a sense that there was you know, there's this character that is me kind of going through life. But there's also, there's sort of this sense, I think back to being very small and onward, there was a sense that there was something there the whole time, which I still have now. Is that a useful, is that just a figment of my imagination, or is that
something there in a wholesome way?
Yeah, like almost like that. It was observing the entire process, and it hasn't changed since I was a little boy till now. Is that just a complete figment of the imagination, or could that possibly be something to kind of focus, not continually go back in my memory, but because I still have that sense of that now, and kind of touch into that a little bit. Is that what you think?
But the way I look at it is we all invent our stories, right? We all have a narrative how we describe our lives. And then if you took, like your sister, she might describe your narrative different than you would describe your own narrative. And I look at my narrative in the same way. There's something that's got me to this point in life. And what's been consistent is awareness and this deep yearning for something which is transcendent. So there's other parts of my narrative I could have emphasized. The foolish things I did, and I sometimes, you know, we all like to joke about those things and the cruel things I might have said to people and the obsessions I had, or so on and so forth. But they weren't the narrative which actually, they weren't the theme which took me to here. The theme that took me to here is awareness in some sense of the transcendent. So in the way I define my life, I said, well, that's the important narrative. That other stuff where I got caught up and was foolish and so on. Yeah, okay, that happened, but that's not the theme, central core of the narrative of my life. Now you could say to me, well, that's just a narrative. Yeah. But I think, well, why not make a nice narrative? Why not make a nice story? Because it does kind of make sense. So that's what I do. Because I talk about those experiences I had as a kid. You know, I'd wake up and I'd be deeply silent and deeply loving. And they were only every, well, I don't know, maybe 2 years or something. But they're the ones that still speak to me. And whenever, and this life speaks to that. So, but if you might ask my brother, he would kind of see it completely different. You know, I was doing this and I was doing that, and which is true. So in terms of a personal narrative, I see that that's, for me, I define myself in that way, and then I give up the whole self-definition of time. Because what's transcendent then is the whole, I mean, time is very important in the spiritual life, in terms of how we self-reference, in terms of like, I'm 68 years old and I was born, and so on and so forth. But I can't even prove that. I can only know that's a perception in the mind, and that I'm moving to some kind of future death. And that, to me, is the most important element of time and a personal narrative, is that the whole sense of me as a being moving through time is only a perception in the moment. And when I can not believe that perception and yet say it's true in some way, yeah, it's functionally true, I have a passport and that, but that the transcendent is no longer identifying with birth and death. And that's not just a game to play, but actually like seeing the whole sense of me in time as an object. And that's, to me, where you enter into the timeless. So both are important for me. I've thought a lot in the same way. What is my own narrative? Why am I here now? Why am I doing this now? And that was the theme. But then what is the theme for me? And the theme is that I am not the Khandas. You know, that's not my true home, not my true identity. So more, you know, that I define it now is that the Khandas went through time, but that initial insight was always timeless. And that's what I think you're referring to, is there's something timeless in this experience of being a man for so many years that was not the strengths or weaknesses, the success or failures, it was something other. And then that's where you get beyond, I think, personal narratives, without dismissing them. And so I see that the Khandas have had a narrative, these needs have had a narrative, and there's a narrative to this, to all of this, which I have been a part of. But my curiosity, which is what's other than the narrative, and I think that's what you're pointing to, and that's the way I would interpret it, at least. Something timeless, which does not dismiss time. It just knows that the time, chronological time, moves in the timeless. And you can't really speak that way to many people. They just think you're doing gobbledygook on them, right? It's a kind of, but there is something in it. Does that kind of get to it? Yeah. So I would honor that, yeah. But then the way you honor it is to no longer, to see your you know, like all your self-definitions of who you did and what you did and who you should be in that, that's just an object. That's just a thought, just a perception. No longer picking it all up. It still comes, you know. So like my mom died on the 22nd, so lots of memories now of my mom and lots of memories, you know, I could have done more. And I know darn well I was, you know, I did a lot, but still those memories will come up the last days. Oh, it's just a memory. Don't give it any, it's a powerful memory, but I don't give it the fuel of self-view. And that's, I think, where the real freedom lies. Think of the fuel of believing I am someone in time. And so you go back to the Four Noble Truths, and you can see like the third noble truth is desirelessness. To me, it seems Nirodha. And any sense of me becoming something in time would be against that. I am someone who needs to become something. So you return more to that which you've always kind of known from childhood. You do wonder sometimes what kids are going through when they're silent and their eyes are somewhere else and we don't know how to relate to them. I do wonder. Not having been a parent, I don't know.
Could I ask you to talk just a little bit, anything really, on the Brahma Viharas? I've just been
reading with them.
Heard it?
You've been reading about them or just practicing?
Yeah, I was listening to a talk and sort of finally realized I knew what the four were. I was proud of myself to just be able
they're
to
very,
I don't know, just...
I think they're the emotional component of freedom. So there's like an intellectual understanding component of freedom. There's a kind of meditative sense of emptiness. And then there's our emotional part. And our emotional part is when we're not identifying with fear and anger and separation, alien. We're not identifying with those. When the mind isn't caught up with those identities, then the heart responds to life in a very spontaneous way, but it responds from a place which isn't bound by ego, bound by personal agendas, bound by fearful histories. You know, it's not bound at all. So it's kind of available to respond to the need or the situation or the joy of the situation. And that response then is defined in four ways in Theravada, we're called the Brahma Viharas, and Brahma means godlike or divine, and Vihara is abiding. So you could say it's the divine abiding. And that's divinity as experienced in human consciousness rather than in some other consciousness. But there, so divinity can be a good or bad word, depends how you use it. But the Buddha used the existing words in the Hindu culture, and Brahma is one of the chief gods. Brahma realms is godly realm, so he humanized it. And so these four ways of relating to the moment depend on the moment, and the first one, which we call metta, we hear that a lot, and it's sometimes defined as loving kindness, but it's I see as more basic than loving kindness. I see it more as not wishing anyone any harm, or wishing goodwill to all beings. So it's a sense of goodwill to all beings, in all directions, in all manners. And you can see, when I have no agenda in the moment of what I want from this moment, or what I'm fearful about this moment, when I have no agenda and there's nothing constraining my heart, then and this is the beauty, I think, of this, is that the natural response to life is, may you be well. Because there's no selfish desire operating. When there's selfish desire operating, then what's the advantage for me if you are well? Or you might be threatening me, or, oh, I wish I had that. That's not fair. I wanted that. Jealousy and all these kinds of things. So it's the sense of goodwill that comes up quite naturally. And one of the ways it's talked about in the text is the way a mom relates to her child. A normal mother-child relationship is the mom always thinks for the goodwill of her child. It's not difficult. It's kind of normal. Because there isn't a kind of agenda there of personally. It's not true of all parents, but that's what's used. So that's, you could see when the heart's open, that happens. And karuna is the second. Karuna is compassion. And that's the heart's response to suffering of others, or suffering situation, or suffering of yourself. And that's the response of compassion. So the first is just a sense of goodwill. But then karuna is when someone looks down, you say, hey, can I help you? Why? And why? Because the heart responds, because the heart's available. Nothing else to do. If I'm preoccupied with my own neuroses and this person is suffering, I don't know, I haven't got any space for you, which is okay too. It happens. But when there is, like, the heart's not got any personal preoccupations, it's available, and then it responds, oh, you need a cup of tea, or you broke your leg, let's go to the hospital, or whatever it is. So that's karuna, or compassion. And mudita is the heart's response if there's something beautiful or joyous. So the person, let's say, has created something. Maybe they drew a picture. And you go, oh, wow, nice one, well done. There's a joy. Or these flowers, these beautiful flowers in the shrine, or the deer going by, or a child says her first word, and she recognizes hat or something, and just gaga over joy at seeing that, whatever. And that's you can see that's the heart's response when it isn't blocked again. It's just available. Again, if I'm very neurotic and the kid comes with something, yeah, leave me alone, kid. I'm busy getting enlightened, whatever. So that's natural too. You see it with beauty. Beauty is very important. You know, to bring in the beautiful, not as an attachment, not as aesthetic need, but as heart's response of happiness to beauty. So beauty has a very important place in all spiritual art. It's not possessive. That's why, like we say, like with Buddha images, if you are aesthetically hung up on the particular art representation of a Buddha, you don't understand, you know, because then it's more greed. I like the Buddha with a nice nose. I don't like the Buddha with the big ears, and it's just it's not really the beauty of mudita. As the beauty of mudita, you see a Buddha, oh wow, a Buddha, yeah, he's helped me a lot, got that kind of feeling. So it's opposite is jealousy, envy, those kinds of things. So whenever you're like in nature, you see the sun in March on the snow, really makes your mind happy, the blue sky, it's very beautiful. A gray sky and rain doesn't make you, you know, doesn't affect you. So it can become attachment, the beauty becomes an attachment. So the fourth one is upekkha, equanimity, and that's the heart's response from wisdom. And the heart's response from wisdom is that toughest one a mom has, because a mom can experience mudita very easily with a child. you know, the child has got a good grade or is really happy with a new bicycle or, you know, whatever it is. The mom just kind of likes, you know, parents, they don't ask for much from their kids, I've noticed. And so the child is happy and the mom's really happy for the child. That's easy for a mom. Very normal mom. So metta, goodwill, karuna, compassion, mudita, joy, is easy for a mom. Toughest one is upekkha, equanimity. And that's the heart's response from, again, from wisdom. And the heart's response from wisdom is that you can't always have blue skies. And that people have their own karma. That sickness is a part of it. That loss is a part of it. That even those that I love dearly are going to do stupid things and get into trouble and mess up. And life is polar in that way. It's polar because our sense experience is polar. It's dualistic. It's good, bad, success, failure, and good fortune, bad fortune, good health, bad health. And that's the heart's response from wisdom. And if you, and that doesn't sound like a heart response, but it is, it's the peacefulness of the heart within the inevitability of failure, of loss, of that. It's not a fatalism because the other three are there too. If you didn't have the other three, it could be kind of fatalism. Oh, it's their karma. But because the other have the other three there, you still have goodwill. And if there's something that can be done, you do it. Yeah, there's still compassion. But the heart has a kind of peacefulness to the inevitability of those things. And that's very hard. Upekkha is very hard to cultivate. But I think if you don't have upekkha, then mudita can take you to excitement, like joy can take you to excitement, and karuna, you can go to depression and worry. Right? But if you didn't have the first three, and you only had upekkha, you could become indifferent. It's their karma. It's just a broken leg, it's okay. Or something like that, really kind of dismissive and so on. So it seems to me that the reason, I mean, there's a reason you have those four. And to me, the way I interpret it is that the reason is that the heart, if you watch how the heart responds when it's not preoccupied, that's the way it responds. So like with my mother, I contemplated, like the first three were just natural, easy, lovely. The fourth was very hard, you know, to have equanimity to her pain, to be peaceful with her inevitable, 96 years old, what are you going to have? 90% of it's pain. What else could it be? But that's the logic at the heart. And I watched very carefully what the problem was. And the problem was I didn't want her to suffer. And then you go back to the Four Noble Truths. You know, what is it? What is it? What is the cause of suffering? Well, I don't want you to have pain, Mom. I want you to be free from pain. Yeah, that's good. That's a good wish. That's well wishing. But pain is a part of it. The karma of getting old is a part of it. And so that was, for me, a struggle continues to be, is how to function from the other three and yet also keep in mind that life has these other elements in it. And with the people we love, you see it very closely, how powerful that is. So I recommend for myself and others, it's like whenever any of the Brahma Viharas are triggered in a very obvious way, so like one, I have a strong memory once of, I was in the Ottawa airport in the lounge just before takeoff, and there was a delightful family, parents with two kids, and they were just having a great time. Really just like, usually, you know, the kids are getting uptight on flights. So these, you know, the parents are playing, the kids are playing. It was really like an idyllic kind of family scene. And I had a lot of mudita. And the flight, I forget where I was going, but I just used that mudita for most of the flight. I just kept bringing up that memory and refreshing the sense of joy in the heart from that. And so you can do that. You can cultivate the Brahma Viharas as a basis for calm. Because when your heart, When your heart's feeling those, you really are approaching desirelessness, because the heart's satiated. It's full. It doesn't really need anything else, and because it's approaching desirelessness, it's very helpful in contemplating the Four Noble Truths or just being peaceful. With karuna, the danger there with karuna is of course worry. So we tend to, in Western culture, we tend to do like we send prayers of healing to people and so on, which, I don't know, do Thais do that? In Thailand, do you send prayers? Yeah? You do the same kind of thing. Well, a very human kind of thing to do. But sometimes what happens with that is you just worry about the person. And may they be well, may they be well, may they be well. But it's actually coming from a kind of anxious worry state. Whereas if you feel karuna, what does karuna feel like? Is you see someone suffering, let's say someone someone loses a child. You know, most awful thing. I realize it'd be very hard for me to have empathy towards that. Very hard, because I can't imagine how painful that would be. But I can try. So I can imagine, what would it feel like for to lose your child? Wow. And then I begin to enter into their suffering, and then I have karuna. Because all of these are forms of empathy. It's not like I feel sorry for you. It's more like I feel what you feel. Right? Which is almost like it would be impossible for me, but I could at least try. And then I'd probably be less patronizing. I just what came to mind was a woman who lost her, a family who lost their 2-year-old in Wellington. As I was speaking, that came to mind, and I remember the difficulty of trying to connect to how horrible that must have been. And yet there was a lot of beauty in it. The kid was dying of cancer. There was a lot of beauty and love in it. So I realized that I couldn't enter into the depths of their emotional experience, but I could try. And that, I think that trying is empathy. You can, what would it feel like? What would that really, really be like? And then you got to get a sense, and then you're connected. So that, you know, the kind of karuna is empathy. But then if I worry, so with my mom, I worry about her pain. Oh gosh, how can I fix that? Then I'm actually just in a form of aversion to her pain. Worry about her pain, and that I found didn't help her, didn't help me. You know, it just made her more uptight, and it just made kind of burn me out. And empathy too, in terms of like someone being successful. Like people, let's say I travel to Asia every winter, and some people say I'm envious of you. I said, why envious? Why not just be happy? You know, okay, what's the envy about? Because they want to do it, you know. And I don't want to go there. Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I don't mind. It's very human. But to say, how good are you, Vardhama? You get a bit of warm weather. Nice one. That's mudita. So it's like entering into my good fortune rather than thinking, I want your good fortune. That's envy. And jealousy is even worse. Jealousy, I forget how they work, but jealousy is like, what is it? Like jealousy, I want to negate your, you know, I want to hurt you because you're happy. I think envy is just, I want your happiness. Is that how we, I'll look it up tomorrow. Something like that. But you can see how that can very quickly, you know, someone like me, like if, let's say if Venerable Kama gets enlightened right now, sitting on that bench, right? And he's just shooting forth light and energy through the top chakra and his floating off the chair. Here I am with my 68-year-old niece thinking, bloody hell, it's not fair. So, I have to really pull it. Oh gosh, he's going to be teaching now. I have to teach him and he's enlightened and I'm not enlightened. Oh, that complexity. But the thing about these Brahmaviharas is they are not ideals to be attached to. They're things to recognize as being wholesome. So if you attach to Like if I attach the ideal of like of mudita, and then you know someone else is really successful in monastic life, and I'm not, and I think, I shouldn't feel jealous, you know, but I do feel. No, I shouldn't feel jealous. I'm really happy for them. I'm really happy for them, but I'm not. I'm actually feeling jealous. Then the beauty of the Dhamma is say, oh, jealousy feels this way. You begin with that. You begin with an honest assessment. And you realize if you run with that, that's ego. It's going to cause you suffering and everyone else suffering. But you do accept it with patience. You know, you're feeling jealousy or envy right now. Okay, what does that feel like? Oh, wow, a really alienating feeling. Oh, yeah. And that's the beauty of it. So they're not ideals. They're just states of mind to be recognized as wholesome, to be cultivated if possible, whenever, to engage in them, to make them strong, but not to demand that you be that way all the time. And otherwise, then if they're egotistical, their attachment to altruism, attachment to ideals, and they become kind of destructive. And they happen, they're happening all the time. You know, when you see someone and you say, oh, would you like a cup of tea? That's both metta, karuna, they're happening all the time. You just recognize where they are really bound, they're desirelessness, the manifestations of desirelessness. That's a very important teaching, you know, in terms of how we would define love. We don't have the word. The English word love is a very broad word, which means so many things. Sometimes it's almost meaningless, right? It can be like intense, intimate passion to liking fish and chips or something like that, right? Whereas that, with us, we kind of delineate that. So we're passionate love in relationship, it should go to the Brahma-viharas. So things like sexual attraction or passion in that way is really defined as a kind of attachment. And that's where we'll take you, because it's attachment to the object. So sexual desire is seen to be something which is not wrong, but if attached to, will take you actually away from the Brahma-viharas. It can take you away from the Brahma-viharas. Whereas if you relate to another person not as an object, but you come from the emptiness of self, and you allow the heart to relate from the Brahma-viharas, then I think you see the limitations of sexual desire, and that's okay, there's nothing wrong with that, but you see there is something deeper, and the Brahma-viharas are a deeper aspect of affection and intimacy, but the upeka prevents intimacy from becoming a strong attachment. It's very hard. Intimate relationships are so intense and powerful. There's a lot of attachment that goes on and confusion and so on and so forth. And I'm celibate anyway, so so what do I know?
Well, thank you. That's really helpful.
It's a beautiful teaching. It's deep for, you know, like mudita, really, that's a very beautiful one to contemplate what that means. What is beauty? What is joy? And that, like, if you bring those to mind in your meditation will go much better because they're free from desire. That's why, like, most meditation techniques, you'll see the classical techniques, they do chant the Metta Sutta first. Get your heart in that kind of space. And then that space is one where it's easier to be aware, whatever object you're using. We're all looking at you. This will be in the next book. Take out the names.
Lumpa, could you give us an idea the way to balance each of five hindrances?
Right, so I do them in pairs. Mm-hmm. And I do sleepiness and restlessness as a pair. And those I see as energy forms. So dullness is no energy, and restlessness is too much energy. So for me, I have to first of all assess what's the present energy, how balanced is it, and what kind of practice do I need to do right now with this particular energy I have. So if I, like I was doing a meditation this afternoon before the Patimokkha, and there was a lot of kind of bodily energy, you know, kind of vibratory energy. So, you know, it wasn't sleepy at all. So I realized I just had to really make no effort, just let it vibrate, vibrates, you know, just no effort. And the desire was really to kind of get out of there or do something. But no, don't make any effort. There's plenty of energy. No effort, really. Just, relax. So that's the application of a balancing factor to the present hindrance. So it's no longer a hindrance because I'm aware of it. It becomes a hindrance when I'm not aware of it. The other than dullness, and typically for me, dullness will come tonight as we sit to 12, and then I'll, you know, stick my head in the snow or do something to invigorate myself. But that's a kind of extreme situation because I'm not getting sleep. But so the obvious thing to do is to get sleep if I need it. But I have my biorhythms. Usually, if I'm doing meditation in the morning between breakfast and lunch, then around 10 o'clock, I typically have a period of dullness, no matter how much I've slept. And my mind goes there, and I've recognized that over the years. And then I know, okay, there you are, and I've seen it millions of times, or however many, hundreds of times. And I just know, okay, now lots of effort in the posture. And I know how to get my hara strong, I know how to get my back strong, I know I can do deeper breathing if I want. And I know I just have to hold that vitality for 10, 20 minutes. Just have to be very, very energetic with that. And that balances that. So those are two examples. But energy is something that, like, you know, say what you're experiencing now is a very extreme kind of energy, and you're figuring out how to balance that, which I don't have that experience. And so each of us will have a different kind of configuration of energies that we're experiencing. But what you want to get is you want to have enough vitality in the mind to be present and yet to be still. Right? Too much vitality and you're vibrating too much. Not enough vitality and you're sloping off all the time. You're slipping away all the time. So you want strong presence and deep stillness. And that's the way. So that's the way I play around with it. That's the way I interpret those two hindrances. And then love and hate, right? Another pair. So the mind being liking something or disliking something. So pain. There's aversion to pain that creates restlessness. So that's, you've been working with that. How to be with aversion? So the pain in the body teaches you about aversion itself, not just about bodily pain, but it teaches you about not wanting. And that's, you must be very good at that. You've seen that a lot, the pain in your body. And then the other is just the fascination, the greed mind being fascinated. And that can be fantasies, it can be intellectual analyses, it can be erotic memories coming up, it can be shopping for gherkins in Perth, it can be all kinds of things, recipes. Typically the head cook on a retreat does recipes. They're cooking away there. Or it might be you're giving a Dhamma Desana to your mom. You know, you just had an insight and you're off and you're giving her a really brilliant Desana and she's getting enlightened, and then the bell rings. So you go off into thinking. Creativity, quite often, you know, if you're an artist, you just have this brilliant thing you have to make, and then the bell rings. And if you're, so it kind of depends. If you're very intellectual, maybe you go off into really interesting analyses and then the bell rings. So basically, you get taken by fascinating things or greedy things, and the aversion, you get taken by, memories of aversion and hatred and revenge and so on. So it can be aversion comes up in all kinds of ways. Sometimes it's aversion to an emotion, so it might be a physical pain. So you have to diagnose each of the hindrances. Mm-hmm. You have to know what's going on. And then when you, so what you try to step back and say, okay, this is the projection, this is the storyline, but what's the underlying, what's the underlying reason I'm preoccupied in this way? Because preoccupation is the problem. The arising of aversions, that's not a problem. If it comes and goes, that's natural. The arising of an erotic thought, there's nothing wrong with that. It comes and goes. Why is the mind preoccupied now, minute after minute after minute, or day after day after day? Why is it preoccupied? Because of one of these hindrances. So that's the kind of diagnosing the problem. And then so you get away from the storyline, and you try to just be really aware of what is the desire here? What's the underlying energy, mood? What is it? Before I think about it, what is it really like to feel this way? And then you start to get some sense of resistance or fascination or anticipation. You see it more basically. So I look at it in like, if I look at like greed and aversion, I look at it as resistance and anticipation. Those two, as attitudes of mind. And if it's anticipation of having a pleasant experience or being with someone or building something or creating something, I see that's becoming. And then there's the resistance to something, a mood, an emotion, a bodily feeling. That's vibhava. And they're all, these teachings are always related to each other. So there's a pair. So energy's a pair. Love and hate, repair, and then doubt, right? And then doubt is, for me, doubt is natural. There's nothing wrong with doubt. So why do I get preoccupied with doubt? So if you use that word preoccupation, it doesn't dismiss doubt or greed or hatred. They're not wrong, but why is my mind always preoccupied? So you have to diagnose it, and that's the hardest one to diagnose. People will often ask me, like people who have a lot of doubt, will always ask me a question about something else. Should I do A or B? Or is this about C or D? Or is it too big or too small? It's always doubt. It's never about the thing they're projecting. It's always the doubt. And I know, like some people, I always just, no, it's just the doubt. I said, oh, yeah, you said that last time, didn't you? What do you mean the doubt? And it's just really hard for them to see, well, it's just not knowing. It's okay not to know. So they want an answer. And that's the way you go beyond intellect. The need for intellectual answers, which we spoke about earlier. The need for conclusions. So the person who is very much comfortable with intellectual conclusions and judgments and opinions feels very uncomfortable with the unknown. Right? Hence, when they feel uncomfortable with the unknown, then they seek a conclusion. So the unknown comes up, well, am I doing this right? Maybe I should be doing more of that. And then they start to think. And they don't see that this is just doubt, it just has arisen as a condition. So to see doubt as a condition and know it as just a doubt that arises, stays, and ceases is the knowing of doubt as a condition. The attachment to doubt is the preoccupation with the thinking mind and getting an answer and getting a question, getting an answer, getting a question. And so that's a very tricky one, a very tricky one. So you have to, again, you have to diagnose it. And quite often the diagnosis is you're off projecting out to something, you don't see it, it's the doubt. Should I do metta or should I do breath? Well, maybe metta would be better. Maybe should I do shunyata? Or should I do metta, then some breath, and then do shunyata? I know, maybe I should just do nothing. Maybe I shouldn't do, maybe I shouldn't. Bing, the bell rings. You know, I haven't done anything. That's doubt. Doubt's very, you know, if you look at doubt, you can't act. Doubt always cripples you. You don't do anything. So, and then doubt, of course, arises both as the third of the fetters and the fifth of the nirvana. So those are very important. And the third of the fetters, doubt, he says, you no longer have any doubt about the, you know, Buddha Dhamma Sangha kind of the teachings. That kind of feels like you never have any doubt anymore. But doubt is natural. Doubt is natural. So the third fetter, one way to look at that is that you just know that doubt is anicca dukkha anatta. And you know doubt is an object and you're not attached. You know the Dhamma. But if you have some idea that doubt is something where you have some penetrating insight and never again will doubt arise in your mind, then each time you have a doubt arise in your mind, you seek some kind of penetrating insight. You don't know, you're driven by doubt. You don't see doubt as a sankhara, sankhan. So when it's seen as sankhan and it's not with avijja, it's not conjoined with avijja, it's just sankhara, it's not a problem, just don't know. Arising and ceasing. But when behind the sankhara of doubt is avijja, ignorance, I am someone who doesn't know and I have to know, you're caught. Avijja pachaya sankhara, sankhara pachaya vinyana. And you have a consciousness which needs to find an answer and you're born into the whole intellectual realm. So that's why, you know, Ajahn Sumedho will say, just don't know. It's Koreans, they have a whole, they do that a lot. Their teachers don't know mind. They say, just don't know mind. Which sounds kind of stupid, don't know mind. But what they're pointing to is like going to the silence of the mind, going to the stillness of the mind. So some people, again, some people are kind of really good at doubting. And they can sometimes, I've seen this with monks, where a monk can be incredibly opinionated. And he's so good at opinions. You'll be at a committee meeting, right? And he'll have opinions about topics that many of us, I didn't even think of that. And then I'll have a doubt that I should have an opinion. But later, I go and meet this monk, and he's full of doubts. He's just doubting. I said, how could you doubt? It's nothing. What do you want to doubt that for? What do you want to go there for? And he's just full of doubts. And you can see that the problem, it seems to me, the problem is strong opinions, this is right, lead to strong doubts. I don't know. So there's a dependency there on a strong opinion. Whereas if you don't depend on strong opinions, you know you have opinions. Bin kwam hen tao nan, right? But it's okay not to know. Then you don't tend to have such strong opinions, and then you tend to be free. You have opinions, but you don't kind of hold to them, saying, "No, this is right," and you're wrong. You know. Well, you got a different opinion. Oh, good on you. Yeah, to some limit. I mean, if someone says killing is kind of karmically really good for you, I'd say, "Well, I think I differ with that one." But that whole realm of like strong opinions. Politicians use that. You know, they say, you know, it's really a fearful world out there. We've really got to destroy those other people. That's really, really bad. And they'll frighten you with strong opinions and views. Right? People do that at committee meetings. You know, they say, you know, I remember one person came to me at a committee meeting. Yeah, she said, I was absolutely shattered by that statement by Ubante. And I'm like, God, absolutely shattered. I don't think I've ever been absolutely shattered in my life. What does it feel like? But then I noticed that most committee meetings, she was absolutely shattered. So it was just her way of speaking, right? That she felt marginally upset. But she, you know, she had such a strong way of saying it. Everyone, oh gosh. So opinions are powerful, powerful, but when you attach to opinions, or when you attach to the idea that you shouldn't have opinions, not that you shouldn't have opinions, but you know, this qualm hen, and it might be a very good opinion. Another person's opinion might be very amateur and very actually not grounded in good information, but you don't have to be conceited about it because you're not attached to it. You just know, yeah, that person hasn't had the experience. So attachment to opinions leads to attachment to doubts. It's a kind of funny one, that one. Interesting one. But you notice how, like, knowing Dhamma is not an opinion. When you know that a doubt has arisen in your mind and it feels doubtful, and you're just with that, that's not an opinion. Then puru. So that's the way I work with those. I mean, they're, you know, where you don't, they don't cover everything, those five hindrances. Like, where does fear come in? You think about it. It's not quite there. You fit it in into restlessness. You might fit it into some aspect of aversion, but fear is a, it doesn't quite, I've never found the five hindrances really dealt with fear very well. But I could certainly, in my life, be preoccupied with fear. So, but I think the basic thing they're pointing to is that inability to be present in sustained periods of time. That's what the hindrances are talking about. What do you get preoccupied with? Why can't your attention just be with the color of the carpet and the sound of the birds? Why does it get preoccupied? What are the hindrances? So even if they don't get defined in those particular ways, you can see that there are ways where your mind and my mind get preoccupied in patterns of habit, and those are the things we have to diagnose and figure out ways not to go there, not to get preoccupied. Yeah? So the doubter will say, well, is the hindrance restlessness right now, or is it aversion? I've seen that.
It's doubt.
I think Lompo Samedo is kind of, in the readings we've had, where he's constantly recommending trust in awareness. And he's using the word trust. And I think that really speaks to the whole doubting part. Am I getting anywhere? Is my practice working? Should I be doing this? You know, no, trust. And so when doubt arises, that's where you know, if you have that strength to say, just trust in knowing the way things are, then you're challenging the desire mind, which wants a conclusion, wants an answer, wants an opinion, wants a fixed position. And no, just trust this right now. And that's where you begin to endure unfulfilled desire. Because unfulfilled desire wants you to go somewhere. It's pulling you to some kind of result. And you're saying, no, I'll just trust in awareness. Oh, is this enough? Shouldn't I be doing something? No, just trust in awareness. So trust is a big word. So when we talk about sadha, faith, you know, we kind of think of it, first of all, of faith in the Buddha as a teacher and so on. But you can see faith is a kind of trusting heart. And then when you abide with that, that takes you to something which is beyond faith. It takes you to confidence. And confidence is beyond faith. You know this works. It's not a matter of someone else telling you. You know that awareness works. Awareness of change works. Awareness of anicca, dukkha, anatta is the only possible way. You just know. And that's, you know, you go beyond being a kind of faith devotee into someone who has confidence. But we start with faith. And teachers like Lompa Samedo say, just trust in awareness, see what happens. Trust in knowing change. Lompa Cha, my name. And you can see, like a teaching on my name, it's not giving you a conclusion. The only conclusion is saying it's uncertain. And that's kind of pretty radical, really. And then with us, it's, you know, you'd ask him, have I realized something? You know, you'd ask him some question about experience you had, and he'd say, have I realized something, Opal? He'd look at you, I don't know, have you realized something? It was brilliant. He wouldn't give you anything. He'd encourage us to, you know, otan and things like that, but if you had that kind of question. From what I remember.
When you said trust in our meditation, and you told me earlier on, trust in intuitive.
Okay.
It's not the same.
Yeah, to me it's words.
Oh, it's just words.
Just words, yeah. And that's doubt. Caught again, right? It's just, you know, ways of talking about what you know this moment. Doubt is so quick.